Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Welcome to this week's podcast. This introduction thing is going to be very brief because Mark's in such a hurry.
I've got to get off and accompany a silent movie, which is being powered by bicycle. So, yeah. On the programme today...
Yes, what is coming up?
We've got reviews of Eat, Pray, Love, the new Julia Roberts movie, Enter the Void, the new Gaspar Noé movie, The World's Greatest Dad, which is the Robin Williams film, which isn't the film that you think it would be from that title, and also a conversation with...
Your man Mark Cousins.
Your man Mark Cousins.
Who's made a film. He's a critic, but he's made a film, which is clearly an interesting idea.
Yes.
Here it comes, then. This week's Wittertainment. This is Simon Mayo here on 5 Live with Dr. Mark Kermode. What are we looking at this week, Dr. Mark?
Or as we like to refer to him, number 75 in the Guardian poll. We'll be looking at the whole 3D...
I'll just call you 75.
You can call me 75. Number 75, come in. Actually, it might be 76. The whole 3D, Eat, Pray, Love, Enter the Void, the new film by Gaspar Noé, which I know you've been hanging on for, Simon, World's Greatest Dad, The Town, and more.
We're also going to be speaking to Mark Cousins, he being the film critic turned director, about his new movie called The First Movie, about children making films in Iraq.
I'm trying to text James King to say, how does it feel coming in at number 94? That's a full 20... How many was the math? 21 places behind The Old Man.
Yes. This is the Guardian Top 100.
It's the hilarious.
Can I just say, it's utter garbage.
You may.
Yes. And if anyone works their way through from one, they will see the reason why. That is all I'm going to say.
I don't care.
There's one number that stands out at you and you go, okay, maybe not. I'm not going to say anything, but I invite you to.
It does say here, though, in this...
But not on air.
Weekly radio spats with Simon Mayo on 5 Live have a huge audience. So they've now been reduced to just spats.
Is that what they are?
They've dispensed entirely with the pretense of criticism and got it down to spats. But do you know how James King's entry begins? This made me even more happy. 21 places below. Since replacing Mark Kermode at Radio 1.
Is that right? Yes. Can I just say, just don't read any further.
Okay.
You know it makes no sense at all. You still haven't worked out why, but I advise you not to.
Okay.
Thanks.
No, I know what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
It's that one number, the glaring number that says, this chart doesn't count for anything.
Yeah.
So here we are then with another show till 4 o'clock with some reviews for these movies which are out this weekend.
The whole... Or the whole in 3D, depending on whether that's actually part of the title. Joe Dante a couple of weeks ago wasn't entirely...
Well, the poster seems to say
the whole in 3D. Yes. Yeah. But Joe Dante said that originally that the title is The Whole. There's a long question about this. I mean, Friday the 13th Part 3 in 3D is actually the title. Sight and Sound magazine tie themselves up in knots about what a film's called. And in the end, Sight and Sound say that a film is called what it actually says on the title card. Which is a problem in terms of Last House on the Left, because Last House on the Left says The Last House on the Left, but it's actually Last House on the Left. Also, Eat, Pray, Love, a film about spiritual growth and personal empowerment, which I think you, Simon, could benefit from.
Is that why you were saying to Gabby, Eat, Pray, Love?
Eat, Pray, Love. Enter the Void, the new film by Gaspar Noé, which I know you've been hanging on
yeah,
for.
Yeah.
What are your favourite Gaspar Noé films so far?
Really interesting.
Which ones of his do you really like?
I quite like The Turtle Bucket. Did you see that one? It was about 1987.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a slightly unfortunate use of a live turtle in one of the scenes. But in general, Turtle Bucket, I would say.
Be the one. Okay, good. World's Greatest Dad with Robin Williams and Frozen, a new horror film about people who get...
No, really? Patrick in Leeds. This is Pat Buggy to kick us off here. It's mayo@bbc.co.uk on the emails. Last Monday night, my girlfriend and I brought to a close an uncomfortable day of heavy pregnancy by listening to the podcast in bed. No sooner had your dulcet tones soothed us both to sleep, we were roused from our bed and compelled to hospital by the more swiftly approaching than expected pitter-patter of tiny feet. By dawn on Tuesday, Both mother and baby were doing exceptionally well, the unfinished podcast no doubt being a contributing factor in our baby's philosophical constitution that made labour such a breeze. We returned home from hospital yesterday and will be listening to the show live as a family for the first time today. I wonder if amongst the various necessary housekeeping notices and hellos to Messrs Isaacs, Morrissey, Marsden, Convention, Pentangle, Murphy, etc., you might do us the distinct honour of including amongst the exalted one Killian John Martin Buggy, BA, BA Honours, Doctorate, BSc, and anything else he wants to be.
Very good.
From Pat in Leeds.
Happy birthday to you.
Killian is instantly...
Killian's a great way to say, if you call Killian, you're cool.
Instantly. And Killian Buggy. Yeah. There ain't going to be any other Killian Buggies around.
No. Also, no one's going to mess with him, are they?
New listener. Danielle in San Jose, Costa Rica. Dear Rice and Beans, having been listening to the podcast for a long time now, I'm writing from Costa Rica, having graduated in film and English from Southampton University this year.
Is that the finest university in the country?
Despite being so far away, I intend to continue listening to the show every week, even if I have to wait for a while for some of these films to appear in cinemas here. I also thought you'd like to know I'm using the podcast for educational purposes. I'm teaching English here to the Costa Ricans, and in a lesson today, I played one of Mark's reviews to my students as an example of a good review. I think the students appreciated it, but perhaps unsurprisingly, the end of the review became incomprehensible due to Mark getting carried away. Despite this, my goal is to make my students become regular listeners to the show by the time I finish teaching them. This is a far higher priority than them learning normal English. I also wish the Dodge brothers good luck tonight in the New Forest. Wish I could be there, says Daniel.
Oh, that's going to be fantastic. Have you noticed how the reason I'm not suited up is that after we finish here, I'm dashing back, because we are genuinely doing this. We are playing Beggars of Life, the Louise Brooks movie. We're powering the projector with eight bicycles on a generator, and we're playing live accompaniment to the movie all the way through. So it's going to be a carbon-neutral silent film screening of one of the greatest Louise Brooks and most overlooked Louise Brooks movies ever. You should come down. What are you doing? You busy?
Michael says, "Dear Mark and Lard..."
No, we know them.
What am I doing tonight? I'm babysitting.
You've never watched me accompany a silent film, have you?
No, I've seen the Dodge Brothers enough times.
No, it's different if it's accompanying a silent film.
Dear Mark and Lyon, I was tempted to see Beggars of Life at the Cambridge Film Festival, not due to any love of silent films or the actor's director, but because of the good doctor performing a live soundtrack along with his fellow Dodge Brothers. I would like to offer a big thank you for bringing this noteworthy film to my attention and providing a magical experience.
Okay. Good, but it would have been nicer if it was from you.
I haven't seen it, so it'd be...
No, have you read my book yet? No.
Barnaby Walter in Billericay. I'm about to embark on an undergraduate BA Film and English course at...
Southampton University. Clearly the best university in the country.
Though you couldn't show me a single chart that backs that up.
There used to be a poster at Southampton University which said, "Come to Southampton University and cop off with Richard Gere," because somebody who once did.
Tell us about the poster in Stockton.
Oh, yes. Getting off the airport in Teesside. Got off the plane in the airport in Teesside. There was the most fantastic and, I thought, brilliantly optimistic poster, which said in huge and thoroughly non-ironic letters, "If it's happening, it's happening in Stockton-on-Tees."
Now, Barnaby goes on with this email. He's doing this BA Film and English at the University of Southampton. My question is this. Which five films would you advise me to see before teaching commences at the beginning of October? Whether they're relevant to the syllabus or not doesn't matter. I was just wondering which films were, in your view, the ones to watch in order to prepare to study film in an academic manner. I would have thought, Barnaby Walter, that maybe you should have thought of this before you
applying.
Decided to go and do film and English course at the University of Southampton.
All I can say is that if you're going to be taught by the boss, just watch A Matter of Life and Death back to front. And then, you know, I mean, if you know A Matter of Life and Death off by heart.
Anything else? Another four?
Well, please. The other, I mean, obviously Deliverance, French Connection, because there's the 70s element, of course, Pan's Labyrinth. Yeah, and some Hollywood musicals that I don't know anything about.
One other thing, and then I'm going to say hello to Mark Cousins, who's in Turin, I think. Gavin Harvey.
Is he in Turin now? He's there.
Well, hang on, we might as well find out. Hello, Mark Cousins.
Mark Cousins is indeed in Turin.
Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Hello, Mark. How is it in Turin, then?
It's a bit wet. I came, you know, Italian men always sort of are very groomed, so I put gel on my hair, and then it started to rain, and I'm now all sticky.
Ah, but you see, you made a fundamental error. You don't use gel, Mark. What you do is you use wax, Dax wax. Yeah,
well,
you see, gel...
It's a bit too late, this information for me.
Well, you know, if you're a regular listener, you'd know you don't put gel in your hair, you put wax in your hair.
And as dull conversations go, this is pretty dull. Let me just... do this email, then we'll do some...
You're just jealous because you can't put gel in your hair.
What do you mean I can't put gel in my hair?
Because you've got fluffy hair. You're like one of the little penguins in Happy Feet.
Dear Resident and Evil, having previously had little to do with film criticism, although an avid fan of this programme, I was surprised and pleased to find out that our local primary school now has a film club, which my twin five-year-old girls are members of.
Of which my twin five-year-old girls are members, full stop, never use a preposition to end a sentence with, carry on.
They have to rate the film the following week, which has now become a hot topic at the breakfast table. The first review was for Toy Story 2, which is sort of a local projection.
Good choice.
I will continue to try and turn breakfast into an interesting and challenging film review event. However, I'm meeting resistance from my wife, who isn't a big Kermode fan, and pulls me up on any expression that I use that she deems I might have picked up from the programme. Can the good doctor give any advice on the best way to hold a breakfast film review, as no doubt his house has similar events? Now, I mention this now because Mark's movie is all about kids and films, you see.
So Mark Cousins.
Yes, Mark Cousins.
No, because there's two Marks, so when you say Mark...
Turin Mark.
Why don't you refer to Mark Cousins as Mark and me as...
75.
Is it 75? As me as 75. Thank you, Mark. Yeah. That will cover all the bases.
But I can imagine, even in your house, 75, you don't actually discuss films over breakfast.
No. What we discuss over breakfast is, who's got the car keys, where's my mobile, I'm going to miss the train, why haven't you brushed your hair yet?
What about you, Turin, Mark? Do you discuss movie, kind of review movies over breakfast?
Absolutely not. No. Not at all. I mean, that would not at all.
So I would say to Gavin Harvey, just don't bother.
Don't bother.
I am impressed by a primary school having a film club.
Fantastic.
How about that?
But presumably that is part of film club. There is the national education thing, film club, which has been going for a few years now.
I think it's small f, small c on this.
Oh, okay, fine. Mm-hmm. Well, in that case, plaudits too.
But film criticism at the age of five.
But film club does work to take films into schools, to show films to school children, to get them educated in the idea of cine literacy, which, as you quite rightly pointed out, feeds very nicely into Mark's movie, about which we shall talk after travel. I've become the DJ.
Are you? Is that what I do?
Which is Lindsay sitting there now, so I understand that we're probably going to go to travel, aren't we?
Well, why don't you just go the whole hog? Cut me out of it. Cut out the middleman, and you cue the travel.
A full introduction.
You're listening
please.
To number 75 on 909693 DAB Diddly Bong, and now travel with Lindsay.
Thank you very much, Mark. The M56 westbound, very slow.
So it's 909693 DAB and Diddly Bong.
I'm just.
I want to tune in on Diddly Bong. How do I get that?
Oh, it's on the interweb, isn't it?
I'd like a Diddly Bong receiver, please. I bet they don't have that in Italy, Mark, do they?
Well, I'm sitting amongst old Bakelite phones and everything from the 50s. It's quite a studio here.
Now, and you're in Turin because?
There's this thing called the Pre-Italia, which is a sort of fancy award for telly around the world. And it's been hinted that this evening I might get a prize.
And for that sole reason, I think that's absolutely all you need to be there rather than here. But it's very good to have you on the programme.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you sort of making the effort to come in. So the first movie is this film that we're talking about. Just explain the idea and we'll see where we go from there.
The idea was that I sort of drove in my camper van from Scotland to India once, and the best bit of the whole trip was Kurdistan. I thought with my producer, let's make a film about Kurdistan. But when we went there, because of my passion and obsession with cinema, I decided to make a little cinema there in a village for kids. These kids had never seen a movie on the big screen before, so 100 kids showed up. They watched some films, and then I gave them little tiny little cameras, and they started making their own films. So I thought I would inspire these kids with movies and then see what they did.
And so it's an interesting mix of stars that we have here, but the very best bits, the bits I think people will take away with them, are the kids whose faces just light up the film.
But to
find people who have never seen a movie at all is an extraordinary place, isn't it? I mean, this
we didn't know that until we got there. Just thought it would be nice to put on a bit of entertainment and have a laugh. And
so have they not seen a film even on television?
They have some of their grannies have tellies, so I saw somebody watching a Korean soap opera or something, but none of them seem to have watched films. So it was dead exciting, and it's a tiny village, as you probably saw, completely dark. And so the very fact that we brought a wee projector, projected on a sheet, it created so much light in the village. You could see it from right across the valley, and that was in itself, I think, exciting.
But if you turn up and spend a long time, and you have a film crew, and you're in an area like Kurdistan, in northern Iraq, you're going to attract some unwanted attention, aren't you?
Yeah, we got, I mean, the secret police came along and they said, oh, stop, you're not allowed to film anymore and things like that. There are always hassles about stuff like that, you know, but we were 2 hours from, like, anywhere big at all. So we were sort of so off the beaten track that people didn't really clock us all that much.
So there's two bits then, really, I think, to discuss. First of all, the movies that you decide to show to people who've never seen films before, and I want to take you to task on that.
Okay.
And the other is the films that the kids then go away and make.
Yeah.
So just explain the movies that you decided to show these people who'd never been to the cinema before and why.
Well, I decided to show quite simply what I think are the best films about kids or for kids ever made. The first one's called The Boot, made in Iran, a brilliant film about a wee girl who loses a boot and then her friend finds it. Sounds sort of a bit boring, but it's just fantastic. The second,
and not
film,
to be confused with Das Boot.
Not, it's quite different than Das Boot. And the second one I showed is one that a lot of us saw as we were kids on the telly. It's called The Singing Ringing Tree.
Now, you know? This is the point where I have to go, excuse me, you... I remember being terrified.
The scariest
as a kid
TV by the singing ever ringing made.
Tree. And you decide to show to people who've never been to the cinema before The Singing Ringing Tree.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. For those who have seen the movie will know that it's ostensibly about a handsome prince trying to get the princess. But the next day when I said to the kids, what was it about? First of all, they loved it. And secondly, they said it's about a little man who does all these terrible things and makes storms and does horrible stuff. So they picked on the most bizarre bit of the film, and that's the bit that they loved, you know. So they totally got it. And I wanted a fantasy, you know, that strain in kids cinema, which is fantasy, Wizard of Oz, etc. But I think this picture is even better than Wizard of Oz, and that's why I put it on.
It is true that everyone you speak to about The Singing Ringing Tree has the same memory of being really genuinely creeped out by watching it at an early age, not really understanding what it was, where it came from, what it was doing on television, why they were allowed to watch it, but being profoundly freaked out by
it. Because it's surreal. It's that big, massive, giant goldfish, and the guy turns into a bear and everything, you know, but it's fantastic.
Because then, you know, because the next day it would have been Blue Peter, and the day after that, Cracker Jack, but on the Wednesday, it's The Singing Ringing Tree. Kids gather around and scare yourselves to death.
So
lead us through the other films.
So I did those two. Then I did a brilliant film that's not so well known called Pala Alone in the World, made in the 40s, about a little boy who grows up, who wakes up to find that everybody's gone, the world is completely empty, so he can ride fire engines, he can go to the moon, and indeed he does all these things. The fourth picture I showed was a rather well known film called E.T. by Spielberg, and the reason I showed that is because this is a village where the kids are obsessed by bikes. They just love bicycles. And so I thought they would love the scene where the kids fly up into the sky, and indeed they did, and they whooped and cheered. And the final one on the last day, I just didn't know what to show. In the end, I showed, you know, The Red Balloon, that fantastic film about the wee boy who's bullied. And the kids, but I think partially because they hadn't seen a film before, when towards the end, when the balloons around Paris come to rescue the wee boy, the kids reached up as to try and grab the on-screen balloons, you know, which was fantastic. So it was just, and of course, you know, when you put on anything, you don't know if anybody's going to show up. We stuck up posters around the village, didn't know if anybody would show. There are 100 kids in the village and 92 of them showed up. So it was brilliant.
And you say in your, because you do the voiceover in the film, which is, again, one of the most beguiling things in it. But you say, I've never heard such cheering at the movies.
No, I've never. And we were all, I mean, I was filming. I was sick. I was filming. There were guns around. So there was a wee bit of tension. But I and my team, we had a very tiny crew, we sort of had tears in our eyes, and we were phoning our friends with one hand going, just listen to this noise that these kids are making. You know, this is rapture. This is what cinema does. You know, it gives you this kind of high, you know. And they were just seeing all sorts of things. They particularly loved the Iranian film, you know, because it's sort of close to home. But they were seeing all sorts of stuff that they hadn't seen before, you know, a kind of surrealism of the image, you know, a kind of... this kind of plenitude that was incredibly moving. If I ever had to be reminded that cinema matters for kids, you know, and I went to Sarajevo during the siege and put movies on as well there, Simon, and that sort of taught me that cinema isn't just like a wee fluffy icing on the cake, you know, but boy, did this remind me of how great it is.
And before we get to onto the movies that they then went and made, you clearly link your upbringing in 70s Belfast into why you're interested as to the kind of experiences they're going to tell you about.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know. I went there just to make a film about them, but then I started realising that it was reminding me of something and I didn't know what. And what they really reminded me is how that when you're growing up in a war, even a really low-temperature war like the Belfast one, the Northern Ireland one, you're not in war like a fish is in water. You're not immersed in it, as it were. You know, you can just, if you're a kid, you can flick between pure happy, pure sad, and everything in between. And that's what those kids did. One minute they were talking about the gassings on their village, you know, where, I don't mention in the film, but of 600 people, I think 160 were killed in one day. So they talk about that, and then they're dancing up and down because they've seen the singing ringing tree, you know. And that's what kids can do, I think, just flick a switch like that.
So you go with these intentions to show movies, and you go with these movies, and you have a projector, and you make the screen out of sheets and so on, and you nail, you know, you nail up the ads on various posts that you find knocking around. So then you've taken these little flick cameras.
Yes.
And how did you choose which kids should have them, and what did you ask them to do?
Well, I just sort of, the next day after we showed the films, we just said, look, we've got little cameras, would you like to have a go at making a movie yourself? And from like 5:30 a.m. the kids started queuing for the cameras. We brought three and we should have brought 30, to be honest, you know, and they absolutely loved them. And I had, you know, even the camera that I was using, the cameras are so small now that I was able to jump in the river with the kids and muck about and, you know, treat the camera like a toy. But these cameras that are simple, press a single button and they went away and they made films. I hadn't a clue what they would make films about, you know, whether it would be daft stuff or serious stuff. And then the film started coming back.
And then what you do from that footage is, whilst you're out there, you start editing it and trying to find the moments. And you find this one particular moment of the kid by the water. Is it possible to describe that, Mark?
Yes, that came about. This was a little boy called Muhammad that we had met the previous year. A shy little boy, he was sort of big eyes, and he looked as if he was taking everything in. Anyway, he brought a camera back, and I was sitting with my translator, and there's a little scene where a boy seems just to be sitting by an irrigation canal, and there's a voiceover. Little Muhammad, the filmmaker, did a live voiceover, and I couldn't believe it, Mark. What he was doing is he was describing the boy's thoughts in a very, he said, you know, he's giving his dreams to the mud. You know, he talked about the boy's dreams, his aspirations, you know. And I mean, it was slightly annoying because I've been a filmmaker for 20 years and I haven't done anything as good as that, so that was, but it was just beautiful. And you know, when you're especially when you're making documentary films, you just have to be decisive and catch moments, you know. And here was a moment, and I thought, God, we have a film, you know. This boy has used the camera like an empathy machine to look into this other little boy's head and realize what he's thinking. Splendid, you know.
And there are other moments where clearly they have used their families to tell the story of the gas attacks on their village, which presumably you would not have got yourself, you know, being a stranger, you wouldn't have got, or would have taken you many weeks of sort of cajoling to get them to tell that tale.
Or maybe I would have got it in a kind of journalistic way or something. So, you know, and what happened there was, I didn't know how I was going to deal with the tragedy. I didn't know whether I was going to have to bring it up or it would come out naturally. My hunch was I'd be there for maybe a week or two before the deeper layers of this village would come out. But no. Day one, as soon as they had the cameras, the first footage that came back was a woman standing up, sort of presenting herself to camera, as you saw.
She's like ramrod talking, straight, isn't she? She's
ramrod
quite
straight,
tense about it.
Yeah, and she starts to cry. She says, you know, I wiped my kids' eyes because there was gas in them. I didn't know that there was gas in the water, and then my kids went blind. She starts to cry. And there's a sort of tragicomic aspect. You know, there's one woman said, I lost 9 of my family, and another says, 9, that's nothing, I lost 12, you know. And it's also almost, it always gets a laugh in the cinema when that scene comes up. And so that just came right out there. I did not bring that up. The kids, again, it's sort of, it's the point I was making, you know, happy and sad coexisting, you know, and the kids just came right out with these stories at this, as the same time as they were doing the fun stuff, jumping in the river.
And there's another woman who is telling her version of the same story of the chemical attacks. And again, an example of the different kind of treatment that you would have got.
Yes.
But clearly she's irritated by one of the questions and she just says, shut up, stupid boy. I'm sure many interviewees have wished to say that. But,
That's fantastic. And I just felt that what I realised when I got there was that I would start making this film and then like a relay race, like a pass the parcel almost, you know, you would hand on to the kids. And yeah, and that's what was, it was great.
We'll talk more with Mark Cousins about his film and where you can see it. It's called The First Movie. We'll talk more with Mark the other side of the news. That's Mark Cousins, also number 75. He's going to be talking as well with some
reviews. You're going to stick with that, aren't you, now?
Well, only because you made such a big deal about
it. Good, no, great. I embrace it. It's like a prisoner thing.
In fact, this from Robin Bewdley.
I am not a number.
Dear 75 and not placed.
Yeah.
How can Aaron Sorkin be 10 points above Danny Boyle? There is no justice. Anyway,
can I just say that I'm apparently 12 points above Catherine Bigelow, which...
I'd also like to say Aaron Sorkin is on the show very shortly. So, you know, if he is above Danny Boyle, who was also on the show shortly... Oh, I don't know. It's very confusing.
He's coming live from the Phoenix in East Finchley, though, which has just celebrated its 100th anniversary and is, quite frankly, my favourite cinema in the world.
This is Five Live. We have some witty time between now and 4 o'clock. Some movie reviews to come. Mark Cousins is with us. He's in Turin, Lucky Man. The first movie is his film that we've been talking about. Is this going to be a tricky film to find? How are people going to be able to see this one, Mark?
It's coming to the cinemas, Simon. We're doing, I think, 25 cities in October and 2 screenings a day. So, like... quite a bit in London and Newcastle and Poole and Exeter and Bristol and Brighton, lots of places, you know, but only 2 screenings in each city, you know, and the first one is especially for younger people and then the other one's for anybody, you know.
See, I think it would be a mistake to make it sound too worthy.
Absolutely.
And I'm just on the press release, you see, Mark, here it says... the first movie is a valuable tool in the teaching of understanding of others, citizenship, film and self-expression, and the nature of Islam. And when I read that, I thought, well, yeah, kind of, but it's just a good film, you know, with some beguiling kids and a very interesting story to tell.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I mean, you probably noticed that I don't even mention that it's set in Iraq until about 70 minutes in. The word Iraq isn't mentioned, because I think if you mention that, for example, people just put on, like, Iraq-shaped glasses and they expect it to be about a problem, you know. No, and it's not really about a problem. It's just more lively, I hope, than that.
But I wonder if there'll be people... obviously, they know it's... You know, even though you don't say it, they will have worked that one out. And you will see it through the general perspective of particularly people hearing the news about the Taliban fighting back and how they treat women and what they think of the arts and so on. And think, I wonder... I mean, I know this is in northern Iraq and it's in Kurdistan, but... elsewhere where the Taliban are fighting back, this kind of thing, you know, if they could stop it, they certainly would. The idea of kids making films would be something that would, you know, just would not happen.
Absolutely, you know, and you want, I think that whatever happens in Iraq in the future, in Kurdistan in the future, you want these brilliant, lively minds just to get their hands on cameras and tell the stories. It shouldn't be me going over there and making a film, you know, it should be those kids. And of course, that itself is probably subversive, but you just hope that they'll make brilliant things, you know, not necessarily works of journalism or teaching or any of that, you know, just a purely want to find a David Lynch in Iraq.
We should say, in terms of the way that an audience will respond to this, because we played this at the Shetland Film Festival, which I programmed, so just a few weeks ago. We took it up to Shetland, and the producer of the film came along and did a Q&A afterwards, and it was a packed screening. Mm. And the film played really, really well. I mean, I hope you heard about the screening, Mark.
It's
a shame we couldn't get you there, but I know you were on your international travels. But what was interesting was how many people afterwards didn't talk about it in any frame of reference towards it being a documentary, but talked about it as a piece of poetry, as a piece of sort of visual poetry. I mean, it is a very poetic film. I mean, I think it's a wonderful piece of work. I think it's, as I said to you, I think it's really, really superb. But there's a number of things that are important about it. It has a, you know, a lyrical visual style, which I think is to do with the way in which you've used the handheld camera and the fact that the kids have got such a hands-on approach with their own filmmaking. But the other thing which is important is that Simon referred earlier, he said you do the voiceover. What you do is more than a voiceover. What you do is a narration, which is, I mean, it reminded me, and you know that you should take this as a compliment, of Terence Davis's work on Of Time and the City. It's a personal, it's very, very lyrical. You have a particular way of speaking, which you have a flourish and a poetic side to you. I think you'd accept that yourself. And actually, because we hear so much of your voice in certain stages of it, I think it becomes a piece of poetry rather than, it's much closer to poetry than it is to visual documentary.
Well, do you know, that's fantastic. Thank you. If I'm a film critic, first of all, you know, and the film that I watched before I went to Iraq was Night of the Hunter, you know, and you remember Charles Lawton's great film, Full of Animals and everything like that. And not that mine even touches the coattails of that picture, but nonetheless, I just wanted to look at again at the light and the sort of dreamy sequences in that film, you know. And that's what the great filmmakers I think, and even the modest ones like me, is you sort of nick from the best.
So do you see yourself primarily as a film critic rather than a filmmaker? I thought that you'd kind of now drifted fully over into filmmaking.
Yeah, well, I started as a filmmaker, and then I sort of, you know, there was a head full of stuff of about films, knowledge about films. So I started writing books, and then I did a wee stint on TV as well, you know. So I'm a bit of a jack of all trades. I switched between, you know, and in a way, what it feels all like the same job. It doesn't feel any different being behind the camera or talking as we're doing now about it. You know, you're trying to use either images or words to get close to the contours of this wonderful medium. You know, and there's so many things about the film industry that I don't like.
I mean, I wouldn't make a film. I'm not a film. I am solely, wholly, and entirely a film critic. And I am fascinated by anybody who crosses that that divide. I mean, also because of the fact, you know, you say I did a brief stint on TV. You did Movie Drone, which still has, you know, a huge cult appeal, still regularly on the internet. I mean, funnily enough, I was just looking at the Twitter account just now. Everyone's saying, please say to Mark Cousins, you know, are they bringing back Movie Drone? Because you took over from Alex Cox, who of course himself was a filmmaker, who'd then become a TV. You occupied a very interesting position of a foot in both worlds. I don't think there are many people that can pull that off.
It does feel like the same thing, you know. It's about, I mean, even when I was a wee boy, when I was falling in love with cinema, I would be looking at Touch of Evil one minute and sort of drawing or painting in art class the next, and it felt like the same thing, you know. Even though one was looking and one was making, it didn't feel any different.
I was just thinking while you were answering that as to whether swearing is different if it's a quote from Lauren Bacall. And the answer is, of course, no, it isn't. But anyway, I just wonder if people will react in a different way if it's a quote from Bacall.
Can I just say I'm impressed at how much of a DJ role I've taken. Not only did I introduce the travel report, I also did the official apology for the use of inappropriate...
Yeah, you're taking over number 75.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
Kath in Glasgow. I saw this film in Glasgow last month. It is wonderful. It's uplifting. I love the soundtrack too. Mm. On the subject of the soundtrack, which you, interestingly, to my ears, you're not going with Kurdish music. There's not Iraqi music. I mean, was that the Goretzky Third Symphony you've got in there?
I felt really. What I hate is when you watch
which was great and fitted, and it wasn't kind of token bit of Kurdish music in an Andy Kershaw. No. That's Andy would have said, you know, you must include this because I was walking through Kurdistan last week. But you've gone for an interesting selection of tunes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what I hate is when you watch TV and it suddenly you're in Spain and they've got Spanish music as if that authenticates you and tells you that you're there. When I went to Kurdistan, I heard music in my head. I was responding and being moved, and it was Western music I was hearing. And only as the kids started to make their own films did I start to put Kurdish music in, and that seemed like a natural thing. You know, you can't sort of pretend, you can't slap Kurdish music on from the start. That's wrong, I think.
The other bit, I mean, you... coming from Belfast, might react more strongly to this than I did, but it's the bit, particularly in American films, where they start filming in somewhere like Boston, and all of a sudden the pipes turn up.
It's horrible.
You know, it's just Boston. You know, it's just, you don't have to put pipes on it just to remind us of the Irishness of the place.
No, absolutely. I mean, you try to find something new and fresh, and you know, avoid cliches as much as possible.
Mark from Richmond, I watch Mark interview. This is Mark. In Turin, not 75. Interview Scorsese again last week. Fantastic. Is he going to do any more similar programmes?
Well, I'm working on something ridiculously ambitious, a 13-hour history of the movies. I've been travelling the world for the last 3 years, and I'm making something called The Story of Film. And so it's 13 hours and they've been interviewing everybody from Stanley Donen to the people in the Ozu pictures to Baz Luhrmann to Jane Campion to a lot
anyone
of...
Anyone in the top 75?
I can't remember.
James Cameron, number one, is he?
I thought you were going to say James King.
Number one is not in it.
Steven Spielberg?
Spielberg is... his films are in it. I didn't... You know, you don't want to wait. Spielberg has answered everything, so I'll just use a clip of something, an interview that I did with him in the past, or 75, or somebody did in the past, you know, and you don't need to go back to him and ask him again to describe it.
But your mate Tilda Swinton's in here at number 66, so there we go. But she's one less successful than Peter Bradshaw. Yeah.
But you do have to... I mean, the whole point of these power lists is to, you know, make people argue. But any top 75 that puts Ed Vasey, Minister of State for Culture, Communications and Creative Industries, at 10 above Ridley Scott and J.J. Abrams and Johnny Depp, you're thinking, I don't think so. He's a politician.
I think you're a bit riled by this.
He's just crossed that he's not in it.
No, I don't want to be in it. I'm not.
Number not listed.
I'm happy to be not listed. Absolutely happy. Adam imported down. Simon, Mark and Mark, if you're taking questions this afternoon, could you ask both Marks? See, not me, as I'm not listed. What are the... Wow, a huge category this is to introduce at the end of our conversation. What they think the best Northern Ireland films are.
Oh, blimey, Angel. Charlie. Over to you, I think.
Angel and Elephant. You know, the great Alan Clark film.
Yeah. Elephant has got a commentary by me and Danny Boyle on the DVD, because Danny produced it, didn't he?
Yeah. And there, I think, and the Angel is that fantastic film with Stephen Ray, and I think they're the best two. Certainly, I saw Angel when I was a boy, and I thought, I cannot believe that, you know, the big screen is somewhere where Marilyn Monroe lives or Robert De Niro, not where Northern Irish people live. And so to see a film as good as that on the big screen.
I think the difficulty with that whole area is that it's pretty hard to top A Prayer for the Dying. I mean, I think when you hit that kind of mark, it's really after that, it's just downhill, isn't it?
Right.
I believe that Mickey Rourke is actually Irish.
Absolutely.
Your huge 13-part history of film is clearly going to take you out for a while. But yes. are you going to make another movie? I mean, having made this and having had all this acclaim, and you know, as you mentioned, rumor of awards tonight in Turin. Do you think I want to? You know, I just want to do this again. I want to do something else.
Yeah, I've got another one on the go. I've started the next one, I think. You know.
Is it the second movie? What's it called?
It's the first movie for the real movie buffs, and then there are lots of them listening here today. The first movie was really inspired by Dennis Hopper's film called The Last Movie, which is so brilliant. You know, I loved it.
Mark, it's been fantastic to have you on. I really appreciate that, and I hope the rumour turns out to have substance to it.
Well, thank you.
That's Mark Cousins. The first movie is his movie. We are being live-streamed. You can watch this. So, and a lot of people do. Fiona on this email. Wonderful to hear the reference to Film Club. We started ours last September. Healthy popcorn, great films, good debate, curriculum sneaked in. What more could you want from 5 to 8-year-olds? It's oversubscribed. There's a whole bunch of things. Bill, somewhere near Cambridge. After last week's attention-seeking behaviour, are you two going to play nicely today? Well, I think we are, actually.
Can I introduce Travel while you're doing that?
Now, Andy and Grace, dear little and large, brackets, hands, just tuning in with my 2.5-year-old daughter for our weekly viewing of Wittertainment, and in an unusual bout of observation, she said, "Why is the silly man not wearing a suit?" Which is, Simon, frankly astonishing, given that she barely recognises me. That's Andy and Grace. Yeah. So the silly man is not wearing a suit because he's doing...
Because I'm flying from here to go and do this live thing at the New Forest Festival of live performance of Beggars of Life as powered by bicycles. And I haven't got time to jump out Superman-like out of the suit before. And I think probably it's now time to go over to Lindsay Hipgrave for all the travel news. Lindsay, what's happening on the road?
Thank you very much, Mark. The M56 westbound is very slow from Junction 2 at Shaftesbury towards Withinshaw Junction.
Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. The UK Cinema Top 10.
5 Live. Indeed. 11 minutes to 3 o'clock. Were you smiling at me? Go on, explain why you're smiling.
No! I'm just happy to be in your presence.
Excellent. So we'll do a box office top 10 fairly shortly.
Can I say on the subject of box office top 10, there's three of those that I still haven't seen.
Do you need to go and see a film?
Simon, there are 9 films out a week. Right?
It's all you do.
Yes, I know, but I have to see that. Okay, so the things I haven't seen yet, Diary of Wimpy Kid and Marmaduke, which are on the way down, but I also haven't seen Devil, which opened last week but wasn't press screened, so I have to, having done the press screens, I have to go and see it still. So a review of Devil would be useful.
Is that the M. Night Shyamalan movie?
I think he produced and did the story for it, but Didn't direct.
Okay, so if you've seen Devil, a pithy one-liner is fine for Wimpy Kid and Marmaduke, except they probably won't come in time. Anyway, this from Robert in
Edinburgh. That's why I mentioned it early.
If this email is read out, says Robert, it will unfortunately mean that Dinner for Schmucks has stayed in the top 10 for another week. Actually, it hasn't.
It hasn't, so stop reading.
I'll read it out anyway. Okay. I was dragged along to see it this week after a friend vetoed my choice of Toy Story 3, whilst all my friends were finding it hysterically funny. I sat trying to work out whether I would smash my head against a brick if it made the film end.
Blimey, Charlie.
The only time I laughed during the film was when the person next to me, seeing my distress, asked if I was feeling sick, to which the answer was a definite yes.
It is a really soul-destroyingly rubbish experience watching that movie. And as I said, the worst thing about it is the smugness of it, the sense of all these kind of clever dick comedians all getting together going, oh, well, let's remake that French film, but let's make it not funny, and then let's watch all the audience trying to find it funny because it's not funny, and it's just so not funny. Sacha Baron Cohen's got production credit on it. Incidentally, have you seen the news story that Sacha Baron Cohen is to play Freddie Mercury?
Yes, I saw that indeed.
Actually, that's
kind of works.
It kind of makes sense,
visually
doesn't
speaking.
It? Yeah, because it's either him or what's the name of that singer, that pop singer who thinks he's Freddie Mercury? Mika.
Doesn't really work though, does it? If you had to choose one or the other.
No, Sacha Baron Cohen's a better choice, but it's a small field, isn't it? Sacha Baron Cohen or Mika. Who else could do that?
Catherine Weston writes, dear terrifying Ozark Hillbilly 1 and 2, since bringing my wonderful baby boy Louis into the world in June, I've discovered the joys of mother and baby cinema at the Picture House in Clapham.
Great.
Every Thursday morning. Much to my amazement, the Picture House, unlike everyone else who provides mother and baby activities, do not assume that those who have procreated have been lobotomised, and so we are not confronted week after week with Sex and the City 2 as I had feared. Anyway, she then goes on to talk about Winter's Bone. An absolute treat, says Catherine. I was utterly entranced and wondered at how a landscape and story so bleak could be so beautiful. It put me in mind of the 2004 Aussie film Somersault, which far too many people
have
seen, in my opinion.
Far too few people.
Sorry, slight wrong word.
Too many people went to see that Australian film with that very fine lead performance in it.
Even my son was moved by the film, although that I could have done without, to be honest, as he moved pretty much the only part of him that he can express himself with, and did so all over both his and my clothes. Even being covered in quite unspeakable waste product could not dampen my spirits after this brilliant film, a far cry from the laughably bad Salt, which I was made to suffer through the first week when I went along there. Picture House.
Yeah, you saw Salt and you thought it was
not good enough.
No. And there was that phrase that the critic, I can't remember who it was, who said that just Angelina Jolie spends the whole film looking like somebody whose paycheck has been delayed.
Okay, so
how is Radio 1 at the moment?
Scott Pilgrim versus the World is at number 10.
Which I like, although I understand that it's flawed to the point of demonstrably not working with the mainstream audience. It's for a movie that cost that much, it needed to do much better to be a hit. But I've compared it to Howard the Duck, and I stand by that. There is something in the sort of extravagance of its oddness that I rather like, and I think that in the long term it will have a devoted, hardcore cult following. I did enjoy it, and also I took my daughter along, and she liked it very much as well.
And this from Peter A.C. Munro. I thought it was awesome. Admittedly, I'm 34, grew up with computer games and got all of the in-jokes, references in the music and sound effects. I haven't laughed out loud so much at a film in a long, long time. And can Dr. K please tell my wife, Dr. K Munro, that I love her and she's wonderful, but she's wrong about The Princess Bride.
Does she not like The Princess Bride?
No.
That's a real surprise. So there's anybody who doesn't love The Princess Bride.
Clearly they're wrong.
Okay.
Diary of a Wimpy Kid at 9, and this one-liner from Matt. Diary of a Wimpy Kid is refreshingly innocent and surprisingly funny for a kid's film.
Okay, very
Thank
good.
You. Marmaduke's at 8. The last... There's one coming. Hang on.
Hi, David.
This just in... Jack from Celluloid Heroes Radio Show. As a forfeit for our film review show, I had to see Marmaduke last week. Utter drivel. Inappropriate adult jokes galore. The most unoriginal script I've seen in ages. If there was an Academy Award for plagiarism, this would win hands down.
Very good.
Okay.
Well, I'm glad I missed it.
That done. The Last Exorcism at 7.
60 minutes of, you know, an interesting Last Broadcast-style horror movie, followed by 12 minutes of the most disappointing ending of a film this year. I mean, you know, the hand of Eli Roth was never more evident than in the finale of that film, when it's like, oh, come on, come on, just do it. Come on, just do Devil's Reign. Just throw it all in. You've got to tie everything up, you know. And it's really, it's a shame. If the rest of the film hadn't been as kind of interesting and promising as it was, I wouldn't have been as cross about the end, but I did come out of it going, oh no, you can't possibly have done that at the end. I'll tell you what it reminded me of. What was the name of that soap when after two...
Crossroads, was it?
No. After two series, the bloke came out of the shower.
Dallas?
Yeah.
It was Bobby Ewing.
Well, apparently, I felt the same way about the ending of Last Exorcism as a lot of people felt about Bobby Ewing coming out of the shower in Dallas.
Owen Healy in Dublin. I went to see The Last Exorcism. Couldn't agree more with a good doctor's diagnosis. What was 90 minutes of an interesting take on the same old story was undone by 9 minutes of what felt like a cop-out.
Yeah.
However, the whole preacher exposing the profiteering from people's blind faith plot of the mockumentary encouraged me to search out a lost gem of a film called, is it Marjo, which won the 1972 Oscar for Best Documentary Feature. It's re-released on DVD. Do you know that?
I don't know.
Oh, there's your homework.
Okay.
You won't get to
see that. You mean along with all the other stuff which I haven't seen and still got to catch up on?
At six, it's Tamara Drew.
Which, I don't understand the love fest for Tamara Drew. As I said, I was there in Cannes when it first played, and we appeared to be in different screenings. I mean, I was sitting there watching it thinking, this is a film which doesn't know whether what kind of film it is. I don't mean that in a good way. I don't mean like, oh, it's interesting because you can't nail it down. It felt like they didn't know what film they were making. And then in the editing room, they found that they might have been making a comedy, and that was kind of how it turned out. I mean, there are things in it, individual elements in it, that are quite interesting. Somebody criticised my review, which is fair enough, saying you can't criticise a film by saying what's wrong with it is that you can't put a label on it. And that's me badly expressing my problem. My problem is not that you can't put a label on it. My problem is that the people who were making it didn't know what it was they were making at the time, or at least that's how it appeared to me. And it ended up being, although despite the individual elements, Roger Allen performance, the performance of those two, you know, teenage girls who are really, really good, it just didn't add up to much.
Joe Burns writes, Dear Newcastle and Newcastle.
Very good.
We had gone to see Tamara Drew foolishly before listening to Mark's candid review. About a third of the way into the film, the sound in our cinema started to cut out for periods of 20 seconds or more at first, and then for longer periods. Knowing from Mark's previous rants about the lack of projectionists nowadays, we weren't very hopeful, and indeed there ensued many discussions audible to all the cinema between the manager and the nominal projectionist, who kept saying, all I can do is press the reset button. Eventually, because they all talk like that. Eventually, the manager stated that they were going to have to stop the film because the sound problem couldn't be fixed. Usually, this would have been a frustrating experience. But we were secretly pleased, as having found the first 40 minutes of Tamara Drew surprisingly boring and the characters underdeveloped despite good acting. We were saved from sitting through to the end of a film we'd lost interest in, and instead...
In which we had lost interest, full stop.
Please don't correct the audience. They'll find it enormously patronising. Thank
you. It's not patronising, it's just right.
You don't correct... It's a listener correspondence.
Oh, fine, right. So language is correct through usage.
He likes the show. If you tell
him... It's fine, I like him. I just want him to speak proper English.
If you tell him off, he might just say, you know what, I'm going to listen to Steve Wright. Apparently the oldies are quite good.
He'll
today.
Say, you know what, Steve Wright, I am going to listen to. Full stop.
I apologise, Joe Burns, for my friend, who's an idiot sometimes. We were saved from sitting through to the end of the film we'd lost interest in, and instead were rewarded with a full refund and a free pass, which we'll be careful to use on a film that has Mark's seal of approval. Although, frankly, to be honest, Joe...
Oh, he's not going to bother anymore.
Any old critic. I mean, look for someone else in the Power Top 100 who won't correct your grammar.
Can I say, on the subject of...
That's the thing about James King.
He doesn't correct your grammar.
He doesn't.
Because he knows no better. On the subject of this projection problem, when I went to see Scott Pilgrim at a multiplex cinema in Southampton, the film started with the back curtain halfway down over the screen, so the film was projecting through the curtain. They didn't notice. I went out and said, got the four-year-old outside, said, can you tell the projectionist? I'm sorry, we can't tell the projectionist. He's three screens down now. You can tell him he's projecting onto the curtain. Guy comes back, changes the lens, so changes the shape of the picture, but obviously the screen is still down. So now not only is it projecting through a curtain, it's in the wrong ratio. Go out, get the guy again, bring him into the show, show him, and go, look, does that look right to you? I mean, seriously, the picture picture is the wrong shape and it's playing through a curtain.
And we have another live show in a couple of weeks' time, which is going to be coming... this is Friday, October the 8th, at the Phoenix Cinema in East Finchley, which Mark has already told us is his favourite cinema in the world.
Mm.
Because?
Well,
because
I went there a lot. I grew up around the corner from it, and it is where I saw all the films that I really love, and it's where I saw Exorcist and Devils and all those things. And funnily enough, when they were doing the renovations, I did a talk there, they had this wet concrete outside, and the guy said, "Oh, stick your hand in the wet concrete because we're going to build steps over that anyway." So I did, and then they didn't build steps over it. So there is now a handprint of me outside the Phoenix in East Finchley, which gives me great pleasure.
Now, you can't apply for tickets just yet, but if you listen out for the trails on Five Live next week, they will give you all the details about how to do it. It'll be an online process, of course. If you want to keep an eye on the BBC Tickets website, everything will happen from Monday, basically. How many tickets we got, you know?
Well, it's the Phoenix, isn't it? So it'd be about 300, I think.
300.
Well, I mean, it's something like that, isn't it? It's 300.
200.
Yeah, it looked bigger when I was there.
Not a big turnout expected. No, exactly. Might be 100. Well, it's full.
I packed it out, all 10 of them.
So keep an eye on the BBC Tickets website next week. Listen out for trails, and hopefully we'll see you at the Phoenix Cinema in East Finchley in London in a couple of weeks.
It's got a lovely new balcony now. You can stand on the balcony and look out over the majesty that is East Finchley train station.
Stevie Greenaway in Guildford, County Down. I recently returned from a trip to Chicago, where my friend and I witnessed the filming of some scenes for the new Transformers movie, Transformers 3, it be. Inspired by the guy who several months ago was instructed by Mark to tell the people involved with Pirates of the Caribbean, the new movie, to simply shout,
"Stop!"
I decided to take matters into my own hands. After an afternoon drinking in a nearby bar.
Afternoon drinking.
Indeed. My friend and I hurled abuse at all and sundry on the set and generally made total idiots of ourselves, which, of course, we don't recommend because, you know, that's antisocial behaviour.
It is.
You really shouldn't do it. Anyway, says Stevie, what I imagine is an understatement. We were asked to move on by an amused and friendly Chicago police officer. It was not required, but I insisted that he knew we were under orders from Dr. Mark Hermo.
Very good.
Just imagine a couple of drunk Irish guys explaining to the amused and friendly Chicago police officer that it's all your fault.
Yes, thank you.
So we're halfway through the top 10. Number 5 is Grown Ups.
Oh, which I did catch. And it was yet further proof that I don't understand Adam Sandler. I mean, I think the main thing with Adam Sandler and his just sort of middle of the road, not interesting comedies is that I can't forgive him because he did make Punch Drunk Love, which was so great and demonstrates that all the best stuff he does is the stuff that's really edgy and creepy and nasty. Once you've done that, why would you do this?
We have Toy Story 3 at 4.
Better in 2D than in 3D, and still pretty wonderful. It does put the Toy Story trilogy above The Godfather Part 3, because Godfather Part 3 was a distinct downturn, and Toy Story 3, which I've now seen 3 times, really does hold up.
Resident Evil Afterlife is number 3.
Again, the 3D is a total waste of time, despite the fact that Paul W.S. Anderson goes on about the fact that it's all shot on cameras from space, what were invented by NASA. It is just another Resident Evil movie. It's not much better or worse than the other ones. Mila Jovovich running around being chased by zombies, having to get from one level to the other like watching an old video game.
Devil is at number 2.
And?
Which you haven't seen.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got some reviews on this. Dear Air and Bender. Could I be Air?
You see, that I still need to see as well. And I need to see that before it goes off the big screen.
Devil was not as good as it would have been if it was called Hellevator.
Which is a better name. Is that the original name?
That's Ivan in London.
Okay, that is a better name.
P.S. I was at the same screening as The Hole that Dr. K was at.
Oh, right, okay.
Could hear him groan about 3D from across the room.
Yeah, but did he notice that in the screening that we were in, this is a true story, right? I'm sitting in the screening of The Hole, right? And suddenly this bloke taps me on the arm and goes, "Where are the glasses? Where are the glasses?" I turn around, it's John Landis. Right? Even in the dark, I can see it's John Landis.
What did he make? Oh, well, we'll come on to that later. Loz in Worcester. Went to see Devil last night. What a load of old tosh. Absolute tosh. Lame, boring, and too easy.
Fair enough.
Devil. It's the simplest back of a fag packet set up in years. There are 5 people in a lift, and one of them might be Satan. don't you think that every time? When you get into a crowded lift, you look around, and you, instead of wondering if anyone is going to break wind, you think, no, one of these is His Satanic Majesty. It's a perfectly serviceable, acceptable mid-range horror movie that does the job efficiently and with a minimum of fuss. Reminded me a bit of John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness.
Oh, okay. Well, that's not one of John Carpenter's finer movies.
Right, so that's the devil done, and it's the other guys, the UK's number one.
And, you know, again, I think Mark Wahlberg is funny. I don't think Will Ferrell's funny. The knockabout slapstick stuff between them is perfectly passable. The plot is utterly incidental until we get to the end of the film when it turns into a Michael Moore movie, and there's a long thing about corporate corruption, which appears to be from another film entirely. But it says something about the way things are now, that this is what now passes for a really smart comedy. I mean, I have read reviews of this film that say it's rip-roaringly funny. It isn't. Mark Wahlberg, however, is... I like Mark Wahlberg. I think he's a genuinely interesting screen presence.
Joe in Kentish Town, mm-hmm. who doubtless will be at the Phoenix in a couple of weeks. Dear Guy and the Other, as someone that really, really disliked one of Adam McKay's previous films, Anchorman, I watched it twice and still don't understand why people rate it so highly. I went to see a screening of The Other Guys with some trepidation. This was heightened by the illusion once more of Will Ferrell, who seems fine in lower-key roles, but with the exception of Elf, dreadful when given a major part. It therefore came as a surprise to find that this was pretty good. Decent performances from Ferrell and Wahlberg, ably supported by Batman and Alan Partridge. The Michael Moorish ending did feel out of place, but didn't ruin what was an otherwise decent comedy.
Mm. Other opinions are available.
What do you mean?
Mm. I mean exactly that. Mm.
Well, let's see if we can get something slightly more coherent out of... what's our first...
Shall we start? Well, let's start with the whole 3D, because both you and I have seen it. So, not to be confused with Onibaba, incidentally, which, of course, is one of the scariest movies ever made, which is a 15-certificate movie. Onibaba, which translates as The Hole.
Right, well, we're not likely to confuse Onibaba with The Hole in 3D, are we?
If you're looking for a horror movie called The Hole that's not an 18-certificate, you might well be given a copy of Onibaba.
Onibaba.
It's called Onibaba brackets The Hole.
Yeah, well, it's not going to be... That's only going to confuse stupid people.
Right, well, if you've never seen Shoto Kinto's Onibaba, you should see it. That is a really, really scary film.
But I'm not going to confuse it with a Joe Dante movie.
Okay, fine. So The Hole 3D, or The Hole in 3D, or The Hole, which happens to be in 3D. Story is, kids move into a house. They've moved several times. They move into a house. There's there's two brothers and a mother who is a single mother who clearly has some issues with the father of the children who is absent. They move into a house. They go downstairs into the basement. They discover a trapdoor with several locks on it. They go, what should we do with these locks? I know. Let's open them. And then they discover that beneath their house there is a hole. No. They then invite... I'm telling you this, you've seen it. They then invite the next-door neighbour, who's this, you know, friendly teenager, to come round. And she realises that what they have beneath their house is a hole. Here's a clip.
Some kind of passageway for dead people.
Why would a little girl be down there?
I'd rather know why she followed me into the bathroom at the diner.
Maybe it's a wormhole.
A what?
A wormhole. Like a doorway between different universes.
Oh my gosh.
What?
Wow, okay, you know what? You need to stop reading so much. Turning into a little geek.
When's mom gonna come home?
Not till midnight.
You should have called her.
No, bad idea.
It's fine with me. It's okay with you, right?
Yeah, I mean, but I just think we should, you know, see what we've got before we say anything.
I know what you've got. You've got a gateway to hell under your house. And that is really cool.
So it's that.
It's a great conclusion.
Isn't it? That's really cool. It's that interesting conundrum, which is that it is a horror movie for kids. Obviously, in America, PG-13, over here, 12. The BBFC information states that at 12, moderate physical and psychological threat may be permitted, providing disturbing sequences are not frequent or sustained. The horror here is sustained in places. However, the horror never goes beyond moderate, and there is only one moment of brief gore. So, and when Joe Dante came on the program, he spoke very eloquently about the, you know, the difficulty of pitching a movie, which is a horror film, but for kids. Therefore, you know, the key protagonists have to be of a certain age, and then everyone will complain demographically, oh, if you made them older, then you get an older teenage audience in, but then the film wouldn't work, because in the end, it is a kid's horror movie, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. I think the things to say about it are, firstly, I mean, Joe Dante is a person who's worked in and worked through the horror genre throughout his life. He's incredibly cine literate. I mean, he is a real sort of mine of information about horror films. As you know, his career dates, you know, back to Piranha. We were talking about the fact that Piranha 3D is now, but, you know, Piranha Howling, of course, which beat American Werewolf to the punch in terms of the on-screen transformation sequence, which, I mean, it was very interesting. They were fighting to get the movie out first. I think over here, at least, Howling hit the screen first. Gremlins, most famously, which again rode that line between being a kid's movie and being an adult movie. I still think his best movie of my book is Matinee, which I absolutely love. But he's a lovely, likeable, cine-literate, intelligent filmmaker, and you kind of always feel safe in his company. In the case of The Hole, the first thing to say is 3D Schmiedi. I mean, I know that people have talked about the premiere of the Werner Herzog Caving movie, which has just played at a film festival recently. They said, well, this is it. This is what 3D is made for. And the hole seems like an obvious way of using 3D because it's, you know, it's a hole. It's an immersive experience. Anything that I like about the film had nothing to do with the 3D.
But I would say that I think the 3D works, and it's more relevant in this film than in Toy Story, where there's no point in it being in 3D. At least when there's a couple of sequences where they're shining the light down the hole, and we see it shot from down the hole.
Yeah.
And you kind of think, wow, that actually is shining. I mean, I think that was worth it.
Okay, I mean, I disagree, but I understand why you'd think that. There is the sequence at the beginning with
the
kids.
You've almost accepted my position.
No, I'm saying you're wrong. I didn't finish that sentence. I understand that's why you'd think that, because you know, obviously, that's what an uneducated person thing.
It was when you finished the sentence. That's
stop.
When I thought you'd actually might
stop
have
the thought,
finished the
yeah,
sentence
with which I had finished the sentence. There's a scene when there's a kid lying in a bed throwing a ball up into the air, and the camera's over top, and that's a direct reference to the paddle ball sequence from House of Wax, which of course is the great, you know, the André de Toth 3D film. Interestingly, because the director actually could only see, it was monocular, so he could never see the film in 3D anyway. The other thing about it is there are some lovely cameos. Bruce Dern plays the creepy guy. I mean, I love Bruce Dern. I could basically watch Bruce Dern in anything. And if I know that there's a cameo of Bruce Dern as the creepy guy who is scared of the darkness, I'm kind of sort of on board already. There is obviously, with anything like this, if you're making a film which is going to play to that younger audience, you need to back right off in terms of gore. So what that makes you do is to be, you know, careful and inventive with what you show.
And super creepy.
Super creepy. So there are references here to movies like Poltergeist. I mean, it's interesting. You remember the tagline for Poltergeist was, "It knows what scares you," which is kind of a key theme of what's happening in the hole. And also in the hole, we have one of the things is this little clown doll. One of the kids is scared of clowns. There's a word for that. Is it what's the word for fear of clowns? Is it chronophobia? There is a word for
one
it.
One of our highly trained team is...
will tell us what the word
right
for it.
At this moment.
It's one of those words that
up.
Sounds like it actually means fear of clocks, but it is fear of clowns. And there is this animated clown puppet, which really is creepy.
Yes.
I mean, I don't like clowns at the best of times, and the animated clown puppet is genuinely creepy. And of course, you think, if you'd seen that in a film that was made in the 1960s, it would have been the old, you know, X-rated or previously to that, an H-rated film. What's happened is that cinema has changed, but there are enough, you know, on-screen thrills and spills in the past to have given it a proper full-on horror film rating. There are certainly many moments when they're reaching down into the hole, when they're climbing down into the hole. I think there are several references to Poltergeist, because you remember in Poltergeist they climb into the hole that leads them through into another dimension. There's an awful lot of people tied to bedsheets hanging down into the hole. That's going on. But there are plenty of moments in it in which he's worked really hard to make the creepiness. And actually, there was a couple of moments when I was thinking, you know, actually, is that now too scary to take an 11 or 12-year-old? I know you had the same feeling, didn't you?
I thought it was fantastically, I mean, really, really creepy, until they go down the hole.
And then
I didn't think it was very creepy.
But that's the same with Poltergeist, is that once you get into the abyss, oh, it's just the abyss, that's fine. And the way it's, I think that they managed to stave that moment off for long enough. I mean, in the end, it's by no means a masterpiece, but what it is it's lovingly created. It's put together by somebody who likes his cinema, somebody who, more importantly, likes his audience. I mean, it is a film which is made with a certain degree of respect for the audience. It's made with a cine literacy that it wears very sort of casually. It doesn't, you know, do that Quentin Tarantino thing about ramming all its references down your throat. If you were an 11 or 12-year-old, I think you'd think it was a genuinely full-on creepy horror movie. But we should say that because it's, you know, it's playing to kids' fears. If that bit in Poltergeist, when the clown doll disappears and the kid looks under one side of the bed and then looks under the other side of the bed and then sits up and suddenly the clown doll is behind, if that bit scared you, there's a whole section in the hole that will completely do for you. I'm 47 and I didn't like the clown doll in the hole.
Yes, if you or your children are coulrophobic.
Is that, what's the word?
Coulrophobia.
Coulrophobia, there we go.
From the ancient Greek, one who goes on stilts.
Oh, really?
That's
like fear of the long-legged scissor man, isn't it?
Dear Grammar and Fickle, says Benedict West, watching you two live on Radio 5 Live for the first time, I am, whilst enjoying 75's oversized wavy mitts, a bit perplexed by his insistence on correcting the audience's missives. Film critic, not English teacher.
Yeah.
Whom does he think he is?
That's Mrs. Brown, is it? Do you know to who you speak? To whom?
Enjoyed Mark's wonderful description of a film having the most disappointing ever. Sorry, I'll do that again. The most disappointing ending ever this year. A rare use,
yeah,
a rare use of the contradictory hyperbole, says Rowley in Canterbury. Dear Hamble and Mabel, we was on holiday in Cornwall and we want to say how good was the cinema in Wadebridge. It were a good old-fashioned corduroy upholstered cinema. Saw Toy Story 3 in 2D. Sensibly priced snacks and noise level not too much. Great time had by all. We're looking for the worst grammar just to annoy Mark. And Leon in Colville, I would like to reserve tickets for Finchley, but please note, I will also need one seat behind to the front and on each side to fully enjoy the Wittertainment.
Fully to enjoy the Wittertainment. Oh, no, but actually there's been a thing passed, hasn't there? There's been like a papal edict that you are now able to split infinitives, which is so wrong.
And thank you very much for the handprint outside the aforementioned Phoenix Cinema, which has been sent in by Simon Ritterband, where we can see your hand. Mm-hmm. But what's sort of set in concrete, but what's interesting is that your hand is so enormous that
the concrete is cracked.
It's like the hole.
Is
it fenced off? Do you know?
No, you could fall into it.
But you could.
You could.
Could you? Can you get a helicopter kind of tour around the hole?
And now here's Lindsay with the travel.
Flappy hand.
See, the jingle responds to me, you see.
Thanks very much, Mark. The M1 northbound is still slow from junction 27 at Hucknall to 28.
Ed Preedy in Eckington. Simon, surely it should be to talk English properly rather than to talk proper English. What is proper English? Yours pedantically.
Thank you.
And Leon in Colville, who is the one who wants to come to Phoenix but wants a seat in front, behind and to either side. Next time, we should have like exclusive seat. You know how you can pay for a really big seat
when
you go to cinema in some screens? We should have like an exclusive club for people who've won a competition, which I know we can't do anymore without going on a course. But you know, it should be seating for everybody. But at the front, you get a seat next to you and behind and in front completely empty so that you can have the full wonderful cinematic.
Why don't we
experience.
Get an armchair up at the front? You know where you and I are going to sit to do the show? Actually, the prize chair is just, you're like the gooseberry chair. There'll just be somebody there sitting actually on stage with them. Not doing anything, but just there.
I quite like the Jim will fix it chairs we had last week.
Jim will fix it.
Kate Alexander in Glasgow. Simon, I'm waiting with bated breath for the review of Eat, Pray, Love, having snorted my morning coffee over my computer screen at Pete Bradshaw's review of it while reading Mark's favourite paper online. Looking forward to it.
Or number 67, as I think he comes in
at. Looking forward to it as much as I was to his review of Sherlock Holmes. The much-hoped-for rant failed to materialise there. Don't disappoint this time. How's my grammar? That's pretty good, I think.
You have that on the back of your cars, you know, not how's my driving, how's my grammar.
Eat, Pray, Love, then.
Eat, Pray, Love, which is based on the best-selling... Is it memoir? Is that what you call it? A memoir by Elizabeth Gilbert?
No, you'd say memoir. Or autobiography.
Yeah, but no, autobiography implies more of your life than just one year in which you decided to naff off around the world because you were having spiritual problems. So the story is somebody who's basically got nothing to moan or complain about decides to moan and complain and decides that what they're going to do is to go off, or rather take a year off in order to find themselves. Did you ever see
that? What does that mean?
Exactly. Did you ever see that? There's a sketch on, remember the Kenny Everett video show? You're the same age as me, right? Fine. And there was, it was Willie Rushton climbing up the side of a mountain, right? And he gets to the top of the mountain and there's a guru up there played by Kenny Everett, and Willie Rushton says to the guru, I have come all this way, I want to know, who am I? And the guru pulls out a Polaroid camera, takes a photograph of him, gives him the camera and says, there, that's you. That in a nutshell is the essence of the philosophy of Eat, Pray, Love. So the story is, she decides she's going to go and find herself by going to Italy to eat a bunch of pasta, by going to India to eat a bunch of spirituality, by going to Bali to basically get off with Javier Bardem. Julia Roberts' return to the central role in mainstream cinema. Here's a clip and then we'll do the review.
What are these?
These are rambutan. They're delicious. It's like an orange made love to a plum. Would you like some?
When you put it that way.
Oh, okay.
Yes, thank you.
Beautiful, huh?
Beautiful.
Yeah. So, next attraction of the tour.
Yes.
Food from Bali.
Oh, good. I'm starving. Where should we go?
We should go to the best restaurant in town.
Of course.
My place.
Subtle.
So, what to say about Eat, Pray, Love?
Well, a review would be nice.
No, I know. I was talking rhetorically. Pea brain.
Maybe you could have got that over and done with while you were listening to the clip.
Okay. I mean, it's rubbish, OK? It's long rubbish for a start. It's 133 minutes, which I make just around 10 minutes shorter than 2001, and there's really no need for it to be that. The things that are wrong with it, I mean, obviously, quite apart from the fact that it's just a grotesque travelogue from beginning to end, and it's incredibly long. And I actually thought it had ended, and then Javier Bardem turned up, and I thought, blimey, Charlie, he's going to be in the film for like 5 minutes. But no, he's in it for a whole half an hour, because it was a whole half an hour longer than it needed to be. Quite apart from that, we should say that there is one good thing in it, is that Richard Jenkins is in it, and he's a good actor, and he does get to do the one good speech in the film, in which he talks about he remembers a trauma in his life, in which he very... sort of, he struggles really hard to bring some sense of credence and credibility to the project, and he almost pulls it off, almost, okay? For the most part, however, the big problem with Eat, Play, Love, quite apart from the fact that it has this kind of, what are those adverts that go, this isn't just cream, this is it Marks and Spencer's or whatever it is, this is, you know, Sainsbury's cream, whatever it is, but the whole film felt like, this isn't just philosophy, this is Eat, Love, Pray philosophy, this isn't just, you know, bogus spiritual self-enlightenment, this is Julia Roberts bogus, and we had that awful sense of like, I've gone to a supermarket and I've gone to buy a bunch of, you know, off-the-rack self-help books that tell me that basically, I have to, you know, I have to love myself more. And in order to do that, I have to, you know, run around all these exotic locations. The other thing about the exoticism which really bothers me is that it has the same relationship with exoticism that those Emmanuel films did. I mean, it has this really patronising sort of, you know, Western imperialist approach to all this, which is, oh, I've got to go and find myself by going off to, I'll go to India, then I'll go to Bali, and I'll go to... But these places that are, in inverted commas, foreign, because that's where I'll find my truth. It's exactly the same. There used to be a whole thing with cinema that, and the Emmanuel movies are part of this, and it was the same as the James Bond movies, when people didn't travel that much. And actually, the idea of seeing somebody getting on a plane and going somewhere, exactly, travelogue film, that was part of the appeal of the film. A lot of the James Bond films, you know, drew into that, oh, 007, you've got to go to Turin, oh, 007, you've got to go to, because you're winning a prize, oh, 007, you know, you've got to go to Switzerland, whatever it is. In the very first Emmanuel film, despite the fact that was seen to be, you know, like a racy sex film, one of the things that appealed to people most was the thing about the aeroplane. I mean, you remember the most famous scene from Emmanuel happens on an aeroplane, and it was the fact that it was on an aeroplane.
What is that?
Well, you know, that Sylvia Christel, you know, has a ding-dong with somebody on an aeroplane. Years later, she'd end up... I've just thought of this. Years later,
Is ding-dong... Earlier, you were saying D-A-B and diggly-bong. Is ding-dong the same as diggly-bong?
Yeah, it is. It's basically derived from the same thing. Years later, Sylvia Christel would end up sharing a plane with the guy who only did one James Bond film, George Lazenby, in the series called, it was like Emmanuel Reborn. And the whole plot of it was, I'm not making this up, this is a bit of a diversion, but I'm not making this up. George Lazenby sits down on a plane next to Sylvia Christel, who's now, you know, 50, whatever it is. He says, oh, blimey, aren't you Emmanuel? She says, yes, I am. He says, wow, I wonder if you can tell me any exciting stories. And she says, it's funny you should mention that, because... And then it cuts, and that's a whole wraparound for a series of Emmanuel television programs. Anyway, the reason I mention this is because there is a crass... exoticism involved.
Not
in
eroticism.
No, exoticism, which it was itself eroticized, which underpins the whole
so
of
it's
this.
Eroticized
exoticism.
Can it be exoticized? Could you exoticize eroticism?
Yes, you probably could. And in
so
a way.
Emmanuel exoticized eroticism. Is that what you would call it?
Had I the brain space to take exoticized eroticism? Well, what you have here.
Excuse me, I'd like to order Mr. Blockbuster. Could I have, and others, available? Have you got anything that you would classify as exoticized eroticism?
This isn't just Buddhism. This is exoticized, eroticized Buddhism. And it
not
is
eroticized. It's not eroticized.
No, that's aerobics. It's eroticized, aerobicized, exoticized Buddhism. I mean, it is literally just this barf fest of, I'm going to go to Rome, I'm going to learn to speak with my hands, because you know the thing that I've observed, did you know that in Italy everyone speaks with their hands? You probably haven't noticed that before. You haven't heard the joke about how do you gag an Italian, you tie his hands behind his back. I mean, it's that. And you know what else they do in Italy? You know what else they do in Italy? They eat pasta all the time. And then they eat pizza. And they all drive Vespas, and they all wear smart clothes, and they're all really handsome. Now I'm going off to India. You know what happens in India? Oh, it's all very philosophical. Now I'm going to Bali. You know what happens when we're in Bali? You go on the beach and suddenly Javier Bardem turns up. He nearly runs you off the road with driving a truckload of chickens, and you're on a bicycle. And the next thing you know, you're drinking flaming tumblers of Sambuca with him, and he's telling you to, and I'm not making this bit up, he's telling you to go off with him on a 3-day trip to an island populated only by parrots. Right? This is the plot. And meanwhile, in the middle of this, there is a central thing, which is, I'm learning to love myself.
Are you in any position
to criticize? And I'm sitting there going, yeah, all right, go on, what? Go on. And actually, what would have been really great is that at the end of the film, what the person had learned was, you know what? There is nothing but fear, desperation, and murder. In the, I mean, actually, the last person, the last thing that should have happened, the last thing was she goes back to America, she goes to Hollywood, and Werner Herzog tells her that there is no God. The end. Unfortunately, that's not how it ended.
So what's it called?
Eat, pray, love.
Not fear, desperation, vomit. Murder.
Fear, desperation, miss.
That's what it should be. And can I just say, as I was trying to say earlier, you are in no position to complain about people talking with their
hands.
No,
I'm not saying what I'm saying.
The gale that was coming this side.
What I'm saying is the crassness of the observation. You know, I went to Italy and I noticed that they all speak with their hands.
You don't need to
no!
say it again.
Really? It's unbelievable that you've had the insight. It's like your third eye has been opened up and you've noticed that in Italy people speak with their hands. Unbelievable. Did you know that in Switzerland they have chi? I mean, it's like, what? It's, you know, and in Germany, they all drive Volkswagens. It's just...
Can you stop? Because Justine has to read the news in a moment, and it might be inappropriate to hear a newsreader laugh.
I think you should see this, because I think you could learn a lot.
What, fear, desperation and murder?
Yes, that's right. That's what you call it.
Do you think it's an exclusively an American disease, that the idea of wanting to find yourself? Is there anyone from Britain who's ever in a film said, I want to go and find myself, mate?
I certainly hope not.
I don't think that's ever happened in this
country. No, because they go, no, stop it. All right? No.
Have a pint of beer.
I am not the Buddhist.
Are you going?
I am.
Hands under control?
Yep.
How long do you need, Justin, just to compose yourself before we move on?
The jingle of doom. Thank
See,
you
See, look, she's
much.
Breathing in a kind of a controlled, exercised way.
Centre. Because you know what?
No, don't
it's
start
what's
again.
In here
don't
that matters,
again.
Not right. What's out there.
I found myself.
Very good.
Where were you?
Yeah, she was there all the time. She just was looking in the wrong place.
John Pritchard in Luxembourg. Shirley Valentine was a UK movie about finding yourself. Do you think that's fair enough?
Yeah, but Shirley Valentine was funny and shorter than 133 minutes and had John Alderton in The Buff jumping off a boat, although apparently it wasn't him.
The waft.
Apparently they used a stunt buff.
Stunt buttocks.
No, because it was front
buttocks.
That's even worse. Oh my word, I've just seen your front buttocks.
That's not good.
John Alderton's in Zardoz as well.
John,
you know,
concludes the waft from Mark's hands nearly blew my garden shed down here in Luxembourg. What's this? The best Commodian rant ever, fear, desperation and murder. That's what it's called now.
Yeah.
That's from everyone at Sussex Screen Printing. Sharon, thank you for that. Anne-Marie, dear Karma and Sutra, just waded through Eat, Pray, Love, the most boring book ever, especially
book.
In India. Can't see how the film will be any good. Yes, you're so right, what rubbish. I bought the book back in the day when I used to trust Oprah, which is where it came from. I so wanted my money back by the end of the second chapter. What rubbish, patronising, spoilt, rich girl, and then there's all kinds of language I can't use. Deb in Leicester. Thank you very much indeed for that. If you have actually found yourself... Drop us a line and let us know how your life has changed, because I still think it's an American thing. So it's 21 minutes to 4 o'clock. New stuff.
Enter the Void. You had an email about Enter the Void and... A real question, didn't you? R-E-E-L.
Oh, well, Sean in Woking, when you saw Into the Void, was it with or without Real 7? And please tell us this bizarre story, so you better explain.
Well, a short version of it, Into the Void, which is the new film by Gaspar Noé, who's was most famous, I suppose, for Irreversible, Irreversible, out of which I had to carry a patron at the film house in Edinburgh, because during the opening moments in which somebody gets attacked with a fire extinguisher.
Oh.
No, it was not a bat. Somebody gets attacked with a bat. Oh, you mean a bat? I thought you meant they get attacked like a nocturnal blood-drinking creature. The guy in front of me literally fainted, passed out, and I had to carry him out of the cinema. It was really exciting. I was really, really sort of made the film seem more fun to me in a kind of exploitation way. So when this was first played at Cannes and other places...
So all it takes to improve your pleasure of
somebody
of a movie.
Passing out, yeah. At that point, it was 2 hours 22 minutes, but the BBFC... Oh, no, 2 hours 40 minutes originally. Then it came down. The BBFC say... The film's director has stated that Enter the Void should be projected at the speed of 25 frames per second rather than 24 frames, so it's 1/25th faster. And also that when it was resubmitted, they simply removed Reel 7, So
the whole thing?
Yeah, the whole of Reel 7. So
the whole of it?
Yes. So if the film is projected at this speed, the shortened version minus Reel 7 has a running time of 2 hours, 17 minutes and 7 seconds. The original version, including the 7th reel, would have a running time of 2 hours, 34 minutes, 23 seconds at the same speed.
What about the film?
Fine. So the film is a sort of cosmic fantasia, in a way. It is the story is there's a young man living in Tokyo who's very close to his sister, who he's brought over there, who is now working as a pole dancer and is having a relationship with an inappropriate gangster type. Very early in the film, the central character dies, and then his spirit then floats out of his body and then revisits both characters who are alive and in the world now and key events from his life, including a traumatic event in his past which has caused this particular bond with his sister. And then we see in flashback the events leading up to his demise, and we also see him essentially attempting to influence the real world in a sort of ghostly fashion. Now, because he is a spirit, therefore he doesn't observe the physical rules of the world, he goes everywhere, and because we see the film through from his point of view, we go everywhere. And in Gaspar Noé's world, the camera going everywhere means the camera goes everywhere. Do you remember that Vapors song, Turning Japanese?
Indeed, I do.
Do you remember the key line from that?
About. No sex, no drugs, no wine, no women, no fun, no sin, no you, no wonder it's dark.
No, the one about, you know, I want a doctor to take your picture.
Well, it's not as good as mine.
No, but anyway, it's almost like Gaspar has listened to the Vapors Turning Japanese and gone, that's a good idea. So his camera goes where nobody else's camera has gone before in every conceivable way. And we see the whole film from the point of view of this floating spirit. And it's an extraordinary sort of neon-lit version of the world, neon-lit version of Tokyo, but also of a world that is somewhere between this world and the next. The influence of the stuff that he's drawn on 2001 is a big defining thing in this. I mean, there's a reference, a very clear reference to 2001. One in Irreversible. There is here the sense of that, you know, Star Child thing from 2001 going on, because a great theme of the film is whether or not his spirit is about to be reborn, somehow reincarnated. There is also very, very COD references to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, like dialogue that says, "Are you? What's that you're reading? It's the Tibetan Book of the Dead, really? What's that about? It's about what happens to the soul as it departs the body, blah, 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 blah." It also looks like a hallucinogenic trip. I mean, it's the whole film has a kind of hallucinogenic, overlit, trippy quality to it. It's like somebody's playing classic FM turned up too loud in the background with these kind of, you know, strange classical interruptions. And the whole thing is orchestrated through, I mean, I have to say, extraordinary technical proficiency in terms of the way it's shot and edited and put together. I mean, it really is a film which has a vision and which goes places that other films don't go. The question then is, what does it add up to? I think, as with all of Gaspar Noé's stuff, he inhabits this world which is somewhere between art and exploitation, which is somewhere between, you know, adventurous examination and straightforward sort of grindhouse sleaze. I mean, wherever you are in a Gaspar Noé film, you're never far away from something sleazy. If you read the censor's report, incidentally, it will detail exactly for you what I'm talking about in that area. But all you need to know is essentially he goes everywhere. He has an obsession with the mechanics of hardcore. He's talked recently about the idea that he wanted to make an erotic film in 3D. That's, you know, and I, frankly, I wouldn't put it past him. What it all adds up to philosophically, oddly enough, is actually not very much more than Eat, Pray, Love. I mean, it's weird because for a film that's so stylistically adventurous, it really has a fairly kind of boiled down COD philosophy working underneath. And actually, if you read any interviews with Gaspar himself, people said, oh, well, people have said, obviously, I've read the Tibetan Book of the Dead and embraced it. It's like, no, he hasn't. He's just sort of seen it. And it's like, oh, that's an interesting plot point. Let's have a go at that. Let's see what the soul would look like if the Tibetan Book of the Dead is true. And incidentally, I was watching 2001 the other day and you know, I'm feeling a little bit hallucinogenic. And we haven't been in a strip club for the last 5 minutes. Let's just go in there for a while. And the whole experience is fairly head scrambling. When I first saw it, I did a blog immediately afterwards in which I was trying to sort of, you know, gather my thoughts. I mean, it's a movie that knocks you down. I mean, it's a full-on sensory experience, and it's a little bit like being art mugged. You know, all this stuff goes on and rattles around in your head. And you go, wow! And then when you try and assess afterwards what it all adds up to, it doesn't really all add up to very much. But stylistically, it's the cinematic equivalent, I imagine, of what it must be like taking hallucinogens, because everything is too, like, too bright, too wild, too weird, too so great. But afterwards, it's a little bit of a, yeah, you know, we're all a bit, aren't we? And actually, and in the end, the journey of the departed soul is pretty much the same journey as the journey of the Julia Roberts character in Eat, Love, Pray, Vomit, whatever it is, which is that, hey,
are there any,
you know what?
Are there any front buttocks in this film?
Oh.
Lots.
Front, back, side, up. I mean, there is no part of the physical world that is not thoroughly examined in Gaspar Noé's. So it's full on. It's distinctive. It's you know, it's ambitious. It's empty. It's overlong. It's noisy. It's exploitative, and it's arty in all the same way. And it's like putting you know what it's like doing? It's like putting your head in one of those machines that makes candy floss.
A candy floss machine.
That would be the one I was looking for.
Kevin Prendergast says, I've just got back from a screening of Enter the Void with a Q&A from Gasper.
Oh, really?
In Dulston in North
Gasper.
London.
Oh, Gasper. Gasper. No scones for me, Mama. I'm off to play the grand piano.
The impressions were that it was technically brilliant but far too self-indulgent. I felt like I was on some sort of medication after the opening credits.
Exactly.
The acting was terrible in places, and to me it seemed there was a natural conclusion to the film, maybe 20 minutes from the end.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Reviewing Pirates 4, it just kept going
on and on.
Which brings me, says Kevin, to the sex. When asked about the amount of sex portrayed in the movie, Gasper was very, very French, shrugged a few times and said, it is life. Well, Gasper, milking a cow is also part of life. And I'm sure in a film I'd find it interesting to watch the process if it helped forward the film. But when you see the cows being milked time and time again...
with ethereal light beaming from their nethers...
it just gets a tad boring. Is that what they're called?
Yes.
Look at the nethers. Well, that's quite enough of that.
That's right. It's called the Netherlands.
And now it's... it's your bit.
And now, here's Lindsay with the top 10 travel tips.
I don't know, I'm not quite sure if I've got 10. There might be a bit more than that now. It's Friday afternoon. Cumbria, the M6, there is an accident involving a car transporter blocking...
Just a reminder, next Friday is one of these sport is more important than movies day because it's the Ryder Cup, so we'll be doing live streaming at 2 o'clock, so you can follow us there. But the actual show itself goes out at 9 o'clock next Friday evening. Just on the subject of The Hole in 3D, which we were discussing earlier, this from Robin. Joe Dante's first film in 7 years seems about 25 years out of date, but that is not a bad thing.
Yeah.
It has a great creepy atmosphere, some effective shock moments, and is genuinely frightening, at least in a family-friendly Doctor Who kind of way. Some of the scares are a little derivative. The ghost girl is very much like The Ring.
And also, I'm assuming from watching the way she moves that she was similarly filmed walking backwards and then made it run forward. It's got a very similar feeling to it.
But manages to still be quite disconcerting with a herky-jerky, almost stop-motion movement.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Herky-jerky is the word.
Herky-jerky is the correct
word. The 3D is used effectively, especially in the finale with the distorted oversized sets and in conveying the depth of the hole. The kids are thankfully likeable and give rounded, likeable performances. You actually care about them, unlike most horrors where you're just waiting for them to be slain in some inventive fashion. A very welcome return to form for Joe Dante. Let's hope it's success. It is a success, and that he's not away from the cinema for so long next time. What else is new?
World's Greatest Dad, which is one of the Robin Williams, not the early funny ones. I mean, Robin Williams has made some really terrible family comedies. I mean, he's also made some great films. Obviously, he's in Fisher King.
I like Patch Adams, can I just say? It's a great film.
Okay.
It's good.
Fine. I don't know where to go from that. Okay, so here...
That's how to shut Mark up. This is I like Patch Adams.
So here he plays the father of an absolutely horrible... And like, this was the phrase that I was trying to work this out. A self-asphyxiating internet onanist. A teenager who is just horrible beyond belief.
Is it exoticized?
No. It's just, and the teenager is horrible and doesn't have any friends and everybody hates him. And then, as part of his asphyxiating internet onanism, the teenager dies. And the father, played by Robin Williams, then fakes... the suicide note to say that actually he was a sensitive soul who was alone in the world and had a kind of Kurt Cobain practice. And the next thing you know, the suicide note becomes a hit and a cult around the school. Everybody starts saying that they really love the guy. And Robin Williams' character then fakes his diaries because Robin Williams' character is a failed writer. He fakes the diaries. Suddenly the diaries become a huge thing and he ends up on television. Here's a clip.
He was a sweet boy. Sorry.
But there was a lot brewing underneath.
Tragedy is, I didn't know until his death how sad he was.
or profound.
Here's a tissue for you. Profound. Indeed profound.
Indeed.
You don't know me. This is so beautifully written.
I didn't know. I'm so proud of him. He was a great writer.
Yes, this is really remarkable work.
As you can tell, yeah, the nano thing. The gag going on in there is you can't tell whether he's laughing or crying because the kid wasn't any of those things. The kid, as portrayed in the movie, is just
so horrible. Even when you're watching it, I mean, you can't tell from the sound.
He's faking crying, but actually, it looks like he's laughing because he can't believe he's saying this thing. So, look, it's a very, very dark comedy about suicide, which has that kind of edge to it of, for example, Rushmore or some of the Wes Anderson movies. I suppose you could, to some extent, trace a line back to, you know, black satire comedies like Heathers, and it's Robin Williams playing a deliberately, you know, spiky role. It's directed by that guy Bobcat Goldthwait, who, if you remember, started
Bobcat Goldthwait.
Yeah,
Good old Catty. What's he up to now?
Well, he started out as a bit part player in the Police Academy sequels, wasn't it? And then he directed that really odd, awkward. I can't even talk. It's about a comedy which was called Sleeping Dogs, and then was called Stay. About subjects that we don't want to discuss on the radio. It's sort of
What do you mention it for?
Because I'm saying that he directed it before, and if you know that movie, so if you know, you'll know what I'm talking about, and if you don't, I'm not going to say it out loud because it's inappropriate. Fine. Then in that case, put yourself in the ignorant category. There's millions of people who go, we know exactly what you're talking about.
No, there aren't.
Thanks for putting that straw in the wind, and now we know what you mean.
I don't think so.
So the interesting thing about it is, on the one hand, the idea of seeing Robin Williams doing a movie which is, you know, a dark satire, which is scabrous, about, you know, the cult of suicide, about the cult of self-destruction, which is intelligently done. There are some things in it that you think, blimey, and the rough edges on this really are fairly rough. I mean, there's the depiction of this character as unlovable, not the Robin Williams character, the son character, unlovable, is really, really full on. That what laughs there are, and there are actually quite a few laughs, are, you know, hollow and you know, isn't the world a decrepit and unpleasant place kind of laughs. It attempts at the end to move towards some level of, I thought, rather perfunctory redemption, which to some extent spoiled it for me. It sort of felt like because Robin Williams is in it, we must end on a note of at least the hint of personal affirmation. So eat, pray, love, affirm, rebirth, blah, blah, go diving, actually, in the end. But I did laugh. I was genuinely taken aback by just how out there some of the comedy was. I think that its central idea about the cult of suicide is well thought through. And it's interesting to see that in the BBFC notes, when they're talking about giving it the certificate, they say that teenagers are likely to understand this and see that the film rejects the idea that suicide is glamorous or heroic. Quite more than that, it goes well into detail about the lunacy of somehow being enthralled by the cult of suicide. And so it has, you know, a serious message underneath it. It's a very dark, very edgy, very scabrous black comedy. It's certainly the best thing that Robin Williams has done in a long time. Not a masterpiece, but there were plenty of moments in it in which I thought, blimey, I really didn't expect to see Robin Williams in that film.
So, we have a few minutes left.
The Town.
And The Town has been corresponded about.
It has. Muscular, old-style, sort of 70s throwback thriller directed by and starring Ben Affleck, set in Charlestown, which apparently has this incredibly high number of bank robbers historically. Ben Affleck and Jeremy Renner are two guys who rob a bank. Rebecca Hall is one of the manageresses in the bank. They kidnap her and then dump her on a beach and then realise that actually she lives round the corner from them. So, Ben Affleck's character, Jeremy Renner's character, says, I'm going to go sort her out. Ben Affleck's character says, no, let me do it. But of course, in meeting her, he starts to fall for her. Here's a clip.
The FBI guy told me it would feel like I was in mourning.
FBI? You're working with the FBI?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? The guy comes by, checks in on you, gives you a call, that kind of thing?
Pretty much.
They don't have any suspects, any clues, any leads, anything like that?
I don't know. Not that they've told me. He intimated that they were scouring Charlestown, but they were wearing masks, so I'm sure I'd recognize their voices if I heard them again.
I don't know. Might be harder than you think.
The joke being there, of course, that she doesn't recognise voice. Now, it's no surprise that what happens is that Ben Affleck actually then falls for her. They develop a relationship, which obviously puts him at odds with his former teammates. They're saying, hang on, we told you to sort out this problem, now you're going out with the problem. The plot isn't entirely original. We have seen that story done before. Nor is it entirely believable. I mean, there are whole sections of it that require a great leap of faith. There are nods in it towards the old sort of bleak 70s cop procedural thrillers, and French Connection is clearly in the background of all this, and it has a nod towards that. There is also, there are some action sequences which play out as if they're attempting to reproduce the, do you remember the street side shootout scene from Heat, the Michael Mann film, when suddenly the whole thing turns into, and there's like three blocks of, you know, guys shooting at each other. It sort of attempts to get that, and individually those bits work. I think the problem with it is that in the end it doesn't have either the bleak, the proper full-on bleak nihilism of something like The French Connection, or the really, you know, utterably memorable, unutterably, utterably, delete that word, or the really memorable,
as soon as you start criticising people
other people's
for their
language,
grammar,
your own falls apart,
you're going to be in all kinds of trouble.
Of Heat, I think in the end it is an incidental work. That said, I saw it after Eat, Pray, Love, and it was just great to see a film in which stuff was happening and people were doing things, and there was, you know, and there was a good high spirit. There's a great performance by Pete Postlethwaite, who comes across as genuinely quite dangerous and scary in the way that Pete Postlethwaite, you know, you don't often see him doing that role, and there are individual things in it that you think, that's admirable, that's well done. I think in the end it's slight. It's nothing like as original as it ought to be. Jeremy Renner, much of his dialogue, because he's doing the accent, doing the, you know, the, with the wah sound, wah, there are whole sections of his dialogue in which you go, I'm sorry, I have no idea what you just said. I can follow from your body language that you said I'm going to punch you in the face, but I have no idea what you actually just said. And I don't think it has any of the depth that it thinks it has, but it's efficiently put together and it's a solidly crafted, if somewhat unremarkable, thriller. Can I just say very quickly, on the subject of Frozen, which is a no-budget horror movie in which two guys and a girl get on a ski lift, go upside of a mountain, ski lift shuts down, everyone thinks the ski lift is abandoned, they're stuck hanging above a freezing mountain. What are they going to do? It's like that film.
What are they going to do?
Well, that's the whole point. It's like that film Open Water. They're in the middle of the water, what are they going to do? So it's open water but with skis, or it's a low budget Jaws, therefore probably Piranha, but with wolves. And I have to say, I was surprised for something which is such a stripped down idea, such a tight idea, I was surprised at how gripped I was by it. Yes, it's a small single idea, but there were certainly moments in it in which I was made to wince, and I thought it was very well put together and bodes well for the filmmakers.
Movie of the week.
Well,
you got 15 seconds.
Yeah, I mean,
had all week to think about it.
No, but I know, but it's hard. It's probably, with all the reservations that I have, it's probably The Gaspar Noé. But with all the reservations about that.
Yeah, thank you. We worked that one out.
Okay.
And that was this week's Wittertainment. Say goodbye, Mark, for our podcast.
Bye.
Listeners. Sorry, he's got to go.
Right, guys.
Actually, we're going to hear him leave.
See ya, bye.
Bye. Thanks.
Mark Cameron has left the building. Next week's show will be a shorter hour-long programme to accommodate the Gulf and will be broadcast at 9 p.m, though you can watch a live stream of us pre-recording the show at 2 p.m. by visiting the Five Live website. On the 8th of October, you can join us as we're going to be broadcasting live from the Phoenix Cinema in North London. Tickets will be available shortly on the BBC website. If you can't make it, you can watch the live show on the Five Live website, bbc.co.uk/5live.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's Film Review.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode.